Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Monday, July 27th. I'm Taylor Heckert. The Aquatic Center at Petersburg Parks and Rec has been closed since May for repairs to the building's sewer line. Community members have been eager to return to the pool, but as the construction encounters more complications, it's still not safe for swimmers to return to the space. KFSK reports. When you walk into Petersburg's community center, half of the lobby is taken up by big plastic sheeting. The entire section is sealed floor to ceiling, and it snakes directly to the Aquatic Center locker rooms.
It's kind of like an airlock.
It is kind of like an airlock, yeah.
Parks and Rec Director Stephanie Payne leads me through that plastic airlock to the women's locker room. That's where most of the construction has been lately. We step through a big hole in the wall, double the size of a regular doorway.
They've taken out this wall to make it easier to get materials out.
It's impossible to miss the several massive holes in the floor.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy how big and how deep these holes are.
Right.
And I had seen some photos online, but I feel like you don't really realize how crazy this is until you're standing right in front of a gigantic hole.
Yeah, the magnitude.
Construction crews have cut through 8 inches of concrete flooring to get to the sewer lines beneath the building. Rebar pokes out of the holes alongside the remnants of the floor's heating system. Among the rubble and dirt are dusty gray pipes. Years ago, Parks and Rec staff kept noticing a strong urine smell in the locker rooms. Then, they started having plumbing problems in their unisex locker room. When Petersburg's wastewater department came to look at the plumbing, they immediately found issues. In the men's locker room, the pipes were filled with rocks. In the women's locker room, where the pipe was supposed to connect...
When we took that drain cover off and looked down in there, there was an 11-inch gap. So any water that was going down that is just going into the rock.
Payne says it became obvious that the pipes were settling and separating under the building, causing the issues. It's a problem they've been working on for 3 years.
This facility is now 20 years old this year. And we've heard from other people that, plumbers and things that have done other pools, and they're like, wow, you got by pretty good. Usually it fails sooner than that. I'm just like, really? That should not be the case. That shouldn't be the case at all.
As crews dig into the floor, they keep finding more issues with the plumbing. Payne says despite the additional work they've had to do, quote, so far, the added expenses have not grown much in terms of project magnitude, end quote. The final bid for the project was $1.2 million. The construction is also impacting parts of the building beyond the locker rooms. In 2023, Parks and Rec did repairs to the community gym. Payne says during that project, they accidentally cut through a power conduit that wasn't in their floor plans. To prevent that from happening again, every time construction crews are cutting concrete during this project, they turn off the power.
So when we do lose power, because our main internet hub is in the Aquatic Center, in the office, there goes our internet.
They also can't have the pool's HVAC system on when they're cutting concrete, which they need in order to keep moisture down. That means right now, the pools are drained. It'll be a while before the locker rooms are fixed and replumbed, but Payne is hoping the pools will open once the construction crew is done cutting into the floors. Once it's safe to refill the pools, she says they'll route swimmers to the locker rooms on the gymnasium side of the community center.
I mean, they're not aquatic locker rooms like they are down here. They're not made for it, and they're much smaller, but if everybody is just patient and does the best they can... And we have people that already just come, they swim, they don't need the locker room. They go home that way, and they're just fine with it. So
she says she knows that people are anxiously waiting for the project to wrap up. But Payne says she needs to make sure the space is safe before patrons can start swimming again. Payne estimates construction will be done around the end of August. In Petersburg, I'm Taylor Heckert.
The University of Alaska Southeast is partnering with Minnesota-based Mitchell Hamlin School of Law to allow Alaska students to get a law degree locally. Normally, students pursuing law move out of state. Here's UAS Chancellor Aparna Palmer on KTOO's Juno Afternoon.
We don't have a law school in Alaska. And so most people have to basically go out of Alaska, go to law school, and then if they want to come and practice in Alaska, then they return to Alaska.
The university already has a partnership with Willamette University that allows qualifying UAS students to enroll directly in the Oregon Law School. The new partnership is the campus's first that allows students to complete most of their coursework in Alaska. University of Alaska Anchorage and Fairbanks both have their own partnerships with law schools as well. Palmer says UAS students have two options to pursue a law degree with Hamline. One guarantees admission for qualifying students and alumni and provides a 50% tuition scholarship. The other, called a 3+3 program, lets students enroll in law school during the last year of their undergraduate degree. That cuts the amount of time students typically spend in law school by 1 year. Palmer says she's excited about the partnership.
I think law is a really important profession here in Alaska, and in fact, a law degree doesn't necessarily mean that you become a lawyer. Mm-hmm. There are so many other positions that you can occupy that aren't lawyers, but really use that background.
But
students who want to apply for direct admission must do so by May 1st of the year they want to begin law school. Undergraduates interested in the 3+3 program have until July 15th of the year that they would be able to begin law school. Hundreds of seismic stations across Alaska help experts detect earthquakes and send out relevant information to the public. But those stations could soon identify something new, landslides. As Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, the effort comes as experts pay heightened attention to slides and their capacity to spark potentially catastrophic tsunamis.
Landslides happen all the time in Alaska. But historically, the only way experts knew that a landslide had even happened was if someone witnessed it.
We would just like hear about the landslides happening somewhere, like, you know, like someone flying by, or just like, you know, someone would just see something in the remote sensing imagery.
Ezgi Korososin is a research seismologist with the Alaska Earthquake Center. She says that's a real challenge because in some cases, a landslide could go unnoticed and unrecorded for months, if not longer. That could soon change. The center has a sprawling network of seismic stations across the state that are primarily used to detect earthquakes. But several years ago, Karasosin and a colleague set out to see if they could also be used for landslides.
Turns out, like, we can do that. However, landslides are quite different, so that's why they actually go, unnoticed. We wouldn't detect these unless it's a super large landslide.
The effort involved creating an algorithm capable of recognizing the specific seismic signals usually associated with slides. Today, 200 stations across Alaska use that algorithm, which can, at least in theory, locate slides, pinpoint when they happened, and even estimate their size.
And we're continuously improving this algorithm to, you know, make it more robust.
Korososin says the network stands to fill a major knowledge gap amid heightened concern about landslides and their potential impacts on communities, infrastructure, and mariners. Just last year, a gargantuan slide in the Tracy Arm Fjord near Juneau generated one of the tallest tsunamis on record. Nobody died, but experts say the resulting wave could have overturned boats, including cruise ships, had any been present. The event, in addition to others in recent years, has spurred new conversation around the need for more landslide monitoring and a warning system. Korososin says the seismic network could potentially contribute to that goal.
Obviously, we are doing this for the hazard itself. So one shape or form, hopefully there'll be a warning system at some point.
Still, it's not foolproof. Korososin says a complicating factor is that Alaska is an incredibly seismic place. That means the seismic stations are constantly picking up signals from earthquakes, but also glaciers calving, rockfall, and more. So the big challenge is filtering out landslide signals from all the others and preventing false detections.
It's fair to say that this research is still quite young and we're still in, you know, developing phase.
She says it could be years before the algorithm is good enough to feed into a reliable warning system. Consider earthquakes. Researchers have been monitoring earthquakes for decades, Korososin says, and are just now developing an early warning system. Reporting in Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
Today, diesel-powered boats fish Bristol Bay's waters by the hundreds. But it wasn't always that way. Motorized fishing vessels were once banned in Bristol Bay, and in their place, sailboats dominated the commercial fishery. This year marks 75 years since the ban on powerboat fishing was lifted. KDLG's Jesse Sheldon reports.
Until the early 50s, most commercially caught salmon in Bristol Bay were harvested from a sailboat.
Powerboat fishing is a lot easier.
That's the late Harvey Samuelson, one of the fishermen who sailed for salmon. This audio is from a 2005 interview that aired on KDLG in a Bristol Bay oral history program called Our Story.
We didn't have no reels or anything like that. It was all manhandling wooden corks. They'd get awful heavy. Now you got plastic floats, corks.
Samuelson said, without a motorized vessel, the job was not easy.
Sailing was a lot of fun, but to make a living in a sailboat was sort of tough.
Tim Troll is the creator of Our Story, who interviewed Samuelson. He's also director of the Bristol Bay Heritage Land Trust and author of the book Sailing for Salmon. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game manages the commercial sockeye fishery now, but it used to be federally managed. And Troll says the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service finally allowed powerboats to fish in 1951.
There were still more sailboats out there than powerboats that first year. But within 2 years, 3 years, the sailboats were totally gone or converted to powerboats themselves.
That makes this year the 75th anniversary for the final year of mandated sailboat fishing in Bristol Bay. Troll and the Bristol Bay Historical Society are honoring this milestone at this year's Fishtival in Naknek by hoisting the sail on a restored Bristol Bay fishing sailboat called the Libby 76. The boat is called a double-ender for its similarly cut bow and stern.
One of the best examples of probably the epitome of that sort of 19th century boat building.
The boat made its return to the bay during the record-breaking salmon run of 2022, when it was actually able to dip its net in the water for the first time in decades. Troll and a team restored the Libby 76 in Homer and sailed it back to Bristol Bay to participate in the historic season. To honor this year's 75th anniversary, Troll is releasing a new edition of his book, Sailing for Salmon, which now includes a section on the Libby 76's return journey home.
The goal of getting Libby 76 back to Bristol Bay was to have an example of what it was like to fish in Bristol Bay during the sailboat years. It is, after all, a fishery that was born on the wind.
In the days of Bristol Bay sail fishing, fishermen were cannery employees in processor-issued boats, like the Libby 76. Troll says that sail fishing became obsolete throughout the country in the 1920s, but the continued ban on motors in Bristol Bay was a cannery-supported federal regulation under the guise of conservation.
A lot of it had to do with canneries being able to control their fishermen, worried about having powerboats, that would create an independent fishery.
In his 2005 interview, Harvey Samuelson said it also kept costs for canneries low.
Because it's a cheap operation, cheap way to get fish.
Samuelson was one of the fishermen working to lift the ban on powerboats. He said unions were a critical part of this effort, but that collective organization is missing from the bay in the new century.
We had fishermen's union. Something that's lacking today is any kind of fishing organizations. Here in the bay, there's none, absolutely none. It hurts to see that. Here's one of the biggest natural resources on the face of the earth, and no organization to take care of it. A fisherman's got absolutely no political clout right today. They can pay them whatever they want.
Larice Egli is the executive director of the Bristol Bay Historical Society, which is partnering with the Bristol Bay Heritage Land Trust to hoist the sails on the Libby 76. She says new maritime technology during World War II, plus a deadly storm in 1948, were the final straws in ending the sail mandate.
Many fishermen perished, and at that point, the labor unions were able to get enough attention from the federal government that the Bureau of Fisheries did start to question the integrity of the conservation claims that the packing companies had been making.
Even though sailboats haven't been hauling in Bristol Bay salmon in many years, Egli says the region's sailing routes, embodied in the Libby 76, have shaped today's fishery.
Somehow this boat just seems to have a history that just continues to find its depth in all of the most interesting historical threads that we can explore here in Bristol Bay.
Egli and Troll say their goal is to develop an ongoing maintenance plan so that the Libby 76 can return to the water, allowing more people to experience Bristol Bay's sailing history firsthand. In Dillingham, I'm Jesse Sheldon.
For KFSK, I'm Taylor Heckert.